On a hot Middle Eastern summer night, the young soldier Narabot is gazing at a hypnotically beautiful young woman in the distance. How beautiful Princess Zalami looks tonight. Her mother's page senses danger. See, the moon's risen. It looks strangely eerie, just like a woman who rises from the grave. Tragically, Oscar Wilde was never able to experience the astonishing, groundbreaking revolution in music that he'd inspired when Richard Strauss's opera Salome premiered in Dresden on the 9th of December 1905. Wilde had died 5 years earlier, a relatively young man who'd been destroyed by the vicious prejudice of the society in which he had lived. If only he had been there to witness the explosion that he'd aroused. Although he wasn't considered an aficionado of music in his day, his opine that music is the art which is most nigh to tears and memory reveals an inner musical consciousness that was reflected in the immensely rich symbolic imagery which characterized some of his most powerful writings. And that imagery was to exert an intense influence on some of the most important composers of the early 20th century, and not just Strauss. Wilde would have seen how his plays A Florentine Tragedy and The Birthday of the Infanta were vitally essential influences on the highly original musical ingenuity and also the powerful self-awareness of Alexander von Zemlinsky, who adapted them for his challengingly inventive operas Eine Florentinische Tragödie in 1917 and Der Zwerg in 1922. One of the world's most acclaimed musical authorities on this Oscar Wilde operatic trilogy of Salome, Eine Florentinische Tragödie and Der Zwerg is the highly distinguished conductor and music director of the Los Angeles Opera, James Conlon. And as a simultaneous celebration of Oscar Wilde's vital influence on musical creativity and Maestro James Conlon's 70th birthday this year, in this feature, he's discussing these three operas. And in two of them, the Zemlinsky works, he's also conducting the musical examples that we'll be hearing.
First of all, Oscar Wilde is a very rich source, thought-provoking, challenging, I think, to any society at any time. The art of the paradox. You can see many things, you can read things into it, you can read them out of it. So, I mean, I see certain parallels in these three works. And, of course, one of the most interesting phenomena that took place is that, given the ban on Oscar Wilde's works, in the Anglo-Saxon world in the early part of the century, 20th century, the Germans were really the first to grab a hold of him. And not just for theater, but of course, as we know now from classical music, Strauss's big accomplishment of Salome. Less talked about, of course, is Alexander Zemlinsky's two operas, but it really is a trilogy. Zemlinsky conducted the Viennese premiere of Salome, so he knew it very, very, very well. And it's not difficult to see why he was attracted to the dualism in so many of Oscar Wilde's works.
That dualism, that duality, of course, is what is so ingenious, isn't it, in Strauss, though, as well. I mean, can you imagine, what must it have been like in Dresden? I know Dresden was quite go-ahead, but I don't think anyone had heard anything that portrayed a total conflict and all these different, if you like, pillars of obsession, all coexisting and musically coexisting in this bitonality. I think it's such an astonishing piece. I think it's not acknowledged enough. You know, one reads and hears all the time Sacre du Printemps and the Schoenberg
piano piece.
And things. But this, if we look at 1905, what must people in Dresden have thought? It must have been a tremendous shock.
Well, you're right. Given what are supposed to be the explosive works that started the 20th century, so to speak, obviously the Rite of Spring is there. I've heard some people say the Mahler Six, although the Mahler Six did not have a following. In fact, it was rather late compared to some of the other Mahler symphonies. And then Elektra is usually cited, but they seem to forget that Salome preceded Elektra, and Salome is the quantum leap, I think. It's daring and it's explosive use of so much that would follow it in the 20th century makes it very, very, very special.
In the first century, Johannes, John the Baptist, has been imprisoned in a cistern by King Herod. When the 16-year-old Salome hears his voice powerfully ringing out from the cistern as he prophesies the coming of Christ, she is intensely aroused. And, totally against the orders of her stepfather, Herod, she manages to persuade the soldier Naraboth, who is in love with her, to bring Johannes up from the cistern so that she can see him. When he appears, he harshly denigrates her mother Herodias's incestuous marriage to Herod, and Salome starts to fall in love with him. But when he sees her, he refuses to look at her. And when she then opens out her passionate desires to him, he condemns her as the daughter of Sodom, and he tells her to seek Christ. He is seated in a vessel on the Sea of Galilee, and he preaches to his disciples, "Prostrate yourself before his presence. Pray that he then may grant you forgiveness." When, in response, Salome desperately begs him to let her kiss his mouth, three times he proclaims to her, "You are accursed." And as he goes back down into the cistern, Salome is devastated.
Thank you.
Do you feel in Salome that the polarization of Yohanan and Salome actually sets up almost, after all, I believe Oscar Wilde did call this in French La Tragédie de Salome, does set up a tragedy as distinct from a criticism of Salome, of the role of Salome, sets up a tragedy that she is a victim, really, because she's a victim of her environment, which is disgusting, where she has never seen or felt or heard love, compassion, anything spiritual. She hears this voice. She's only 16. And he, as I see it, Yohanan, treats her terribly. How can he expect a girl of 16 to even understand what he's saying? And I wonder whether that really is where the real duality comes from in this piece.
I think the parallel that I see very clearly, knowing these three works intimately, is Oscar Wilde's playing with the contrast between inner spirituality and purity and the outward physical appearance of these characters. Now, if you look at each one of them, Yohanan is outwardly brutal-looking. He's been in the cistern. He preached in the wilderness. You could almost say he's ugly or terrifying to look at. But he has a spiritual purity inside. You may or may not agree with his viewpoint, but he has that. Salome is presumably outwardly beautiful, and this story will reveal inner corruption, or at least the ability to be corrupted rather quickly and easily. And I completely agree with you, because of the environment. But let's go to the dwarf. Let's go to Tverk. And you have the same issue with the Infanta, who's the daughter of King Philip. She's young. She's beautiful. She also lives in a very cold atmosphere, austere atmosphere, and probably hasn't seen a lot of authentic love or just general human authenticity. Comes this gift for her present of a dwarf born in northern Africa with a strange story. He is an object of derision when he comes into the scene in the court, something to be amused at. Obviously, the point of the gift was to amuse the Infanta. And this is, of course, Oscar Wilde saw Las Meninas. He took the whole subject of the dwarf and the presence of the dwarves in Velázquez's paintings, but also, in the court. And he makes him the character with the great inner beauty and humanity. So you have the same thing again. You have an ugly exterior, but a human and to some degree lightened spirituality inside. And you have two women, both of them beautiful, both of them the daughters of monarchs of some sort. And they both will be corrupted the agent of that corruption will be their attraction to this strange figure in their midst, be it John the Baptist or be it this dwarf. But the potential for corruption is there, and the potential for corruption is, as you say, as they are victims of their environment.
Yeah.
In 17th century Spain, the Infanta, the daughter of the king, is celebrating her 18th birthday, her coming of age. At a lavish royal party, she receives a wealth of luxurious presents, including an oddity. A Turkish sultan has sent her a real live dwarf who can sing and entertain. He emerges from a burlap bag, severely deformed. He has reddish bristles, and he is a hunchback, an outcast. The dwarf is called upon to entertain, and on seeing the beautiful and graceful Infanta, he is entranced, and he sings of his love for her, to the shock of the audience, but to the amusement of the Infanta, who praises and compliments him sarcastically. The dwarf, who has no idea or knowledge of his condition, doesn't understand her mocking, and instead he misinterprets her words as her love of him when she gives him a white rose. The dwarf dreams poetically and erotically of the bliss he will have with his beloved as her brave knight in shining armour. Until he looks into a mirror, and as he sees himself for the first time, he is horrified at the hideous sight. Trying to escape from his crushing realization, when the Infanta returns, he begs her to tell him he is not repulsive, and clutching the white rose she gave him, he desperately shouts out that he loves her and wants to kiss her. She bursts out laughing, but then she scolds him. He's revolting. How dare he suggest something so disgusting? The dwarf, destroyed, dies in agony. The Infanta is disappointed that her birthday toy is broken.
We're going to see the same thing again in the Florentine tragedy, a little bit more sophisticated, a little bit more difficult to thread. But we have, in this case, only three characters. We have a presumably beautiful young Florentine woman. We have her admittedly smart, intelligent, clever businessman, husband, but who has been inattentive to her. And she falls in love with and is clearly involved romantically with a prince of one of the aristocratic families in Florence. So we're going to have the same thing again in a slightly different form. The woman is obviously attracted to the manners and the presumed good looks of the prince. She is treated presumably badly by this ugly, we think, at least brutal exterior of this businessman who cares only about his products. And yet he will outsmart the beautiful prince. And the irony, of course, at the end of the story is that after he has murdered the prince, one would think he would murder her. And she is so taken with the fact that he is jealous enough to care to kill this man, is become some proof of his love for her. She is revived and says, basically, why didn't you tell me? And he said, why didn't you tell me you were so beautiful? In other words, they come back together. This is very Oscar Wilde in its very perverse way. One has to become a murderer. The other has to become an adulterer in order for them to discover or rediscover whatever attraction they had for us. But again, you have that dualism with outward appearances. The prince is handsome, rich, has manners. The husband, Simone, has a rough exterior and is ugly in his behavior. And yet he proves himself to be very smart, very clever, which the prince is not.
In 16th century Florence, Simone, a wealthy merchant, suspects that he is being cuckolded by the handsome young Prince Guido, whom he discovers at home with his young wife Bianca as he returns from a business trip. He sells Guido a robe and he offers to give him anything he likes that he has in his house. Guido chooses Bianca.
Simona, legt eure kecken Zunge Zügel an. Auch hattet ihr der edlen Frau hier nicht.
Ja, ich vergaß und will nicht wieder Anstoß geben. Liebster Prinz, ihr kauft das Staatsgewand, nicht wahr, ihr kauft's.
Erledigt morgen das mit meinem Kämmerer, ihr sollt 100.000 Kronen haben.
hunderttausend, hunderttausend. Von heute an gehört mein Haus mit allem, was es gibt, euch zu, euch allein. Hunderttausend, mir fehlt der Kopf.
Simone leaves to go into the next room, and Bianca declares that she hates her husband and she wishes he were dead. Overhearing this, Simone reflects on adultery and death. He leaves Guido and Bianca alone together, and the two lovers express their passion.
Bianca, der Schalerkrämer langweilt mich. Ich will jetzt gehen. Ich werde morgen kommen. Nenn mir die Zeit.
Mit dem jüngsten Frühmond. Bis dahin ist mein ganzes Leben.
Erlöse dein
Zemlinsky's choice of Eine Florentinische Tragödie and also Der Zwerg as two opera subjects wasn't only to do with the fact that he was so profoundly impressed with Oscar Wilde's imagery. There was also the subject matter itself, which related for him directly to the broken love affair that he had had many years earlier with the lady who became the wife of Gustav Mahler, Alma Schindler.
Zemlinsky is deeply committed and identified with his dramas and the characters. And it's also personal in the sense that, I mean, I'm not into psychoanalyzing composers and compositions because I think that, you know, it's not all autobiography. But still, it's hard to escape this in the case of Zemlinsky because of his first having been in love with Alma Schindler, having been, of course, abandoned by her when she met Mahler, having suffered terribly from this, and it seems that that scar did not go away in a short time. It seemed to cost him decades, or maybe his whole life. Who knows? But he was working it out constantly. And his first big response to that is his tone poem, Die Seejungfrau, The Mermaid, and that's directly in the wake of the separation from Alma. And then 10 years later comes up Florentine Tragedy, and again, you see parallels again that the ugly, talented genius himself, because he was small, he was ugly, and he felt that profoundly, comes up in the character of Simone, he's still superior, and even though the wife, Bianca, with that ironic name, takes on another lover who is better looking, and that represents something to Zemlinsky, yet he outsmarts him. In other words, it's his working out perhaps a vengeance fantasy somehow with Alma. Alma didn't like Florentine Tragedy, and Zemlinsky was deeply offended and said, "How you, of all persons, don't understand this."
Jetzt muss ich nach Hause gehen,
so rasch, weshalb? Vom großen Dom die Glocke schlug noch nicht Mitternacht, ein Weilchen bleibt noch, ich fürcht, wir sehen uns nicht mehr hier.
Seid unbesorgt, meine Freunde.
When Guido is just about to go home, Simone reappears and he challenges him to a fight, first with swords, then with fists. The much older Simone overcomes Guido and strangles him. Bianca, now full of admiration for her husband's strength, rushes to embrace him. "Why didn't you tell me you were so strong? Why didn't you tell me you were so beautiful?" is Simone's reply. And the curtain falls with husband and wife reconciled.
Holt eures. Die Gruppe. bleib heute Nacht noch, ob des Prinzen, ob des Kaufs, mein Stall besser geblieben. War das die teure Wort? Holt euer eigenes Schwert. Was säumt ihr, Mann?
Bianca, hol mein Schwert. Fort da mit Stuhl und Tisch. Die liebe Bianca soll die Fackel halten, damit, was nur ein Scherz ist, ernst nicht werde.
Ach, töt ihn, töt ihn!
Halt die Fackel, Bianca! Jetzt zu dir.
Oh,
5 years after the curtain fell on the first performance of Alexander von Zemlinsky's Eine Florentinische Tragödie in 1917, the curtain rose on the first performance of the composer's Der Zwerg in 1922. Although the idea for that opera had been in Zemlinsky's mind for a very long time, and in some ways it was a continuation of the previous opera.
The dwarf, Zwerg, is another revisiting of that. I mean, he's clearly the Zwerg. He was small, he was unattractive. And then here's this beautiful, unattainable person, the Infanta, with whom he is in love, or falls in love in the course of the opera, whom he can't have, just as he couldn't have Alma. There he is, clearly, clearly identified with that. And yet we see the humanity of the dwarf. We see his poetry. We see his expansive heart, his imagination. We see all of those great human qualities that we like to associate with romantic figures, and he has all of it except for the appearance of a romantic figure. And so I think that Zemlinsky's attraction to all this is not purely aesthetic in the sense that here's an interesting author, I will write something about it. I see a deep attraction, deep investment in the dramas of Oscar Wilde.
Maestro James Conlon, celebrating his 70th birthday this year, has been discussing the influence of Oscar Wilde on Richard Strauss and Alexander von Zemlinsky. And we end with the final minutes of Strauss's Salome, which shocked but thrilled the public in 1905 and scandalized the critics when it was first heard. Herod is obsessed with Salome's erotic beauty. He says if she will dance for him, he will give her anything she wants. Princess Salome begins her Dance of the Seven Veils to satisfy the fantasies of King Herod. She has already decided what the gift is going to be in return, although she hasn't told him yet. What she wants and what she's going to have when she has finished her dance is the execution of Yohanan, so that she can kiss his cut-off head on a silver platter. She is still in love with him, but since he wouldn't look at her, she will caress him when he is dead. At the end of the opera, Salome kisses the mouth of the cut-off head. At last, she has been able to express her full passion to him. There was a bitter taste on your lips. Was it the taste of blood? But perchance it is the taste of love. They say that love has a bitter taste. But what of that? What of that? I have kissed your mouth, Yohanan. I have kissed your mouth. Herod has been watching in horror, and now, terrified of divine punishment, he shouts out to his soldiers, Man töte dieses Weib, kill that woman. And as the soldiers rush in and crush Salome to death with their shields, the curtain falls on the opera that Richard Strauss set to the text of Oscar Wilde, Salome.
Closing scene from Richard Strauss's Salome, performed by Hildegard Behrens, José Van Damme, and the Vienna Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Herbert von Karajan. The art Most Nigh to Tears was presented by John Talansky, and he was speaking to conductor and music director of the Los Angeles Opera, James Conlon. The Lyric Feature is available as a podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and also from the RTE Radio Player and the Lyric FM website. You can contact the Lyric Feature by email, features.lyricfm@rte.ie.